We have worked our way in Daniel to chapter 8, and I've told you multiple times, but the point that I've told you many times is that starting in chapter 8, Daniel reverts back to Hebrew. And from the information that we've already seen in chapters 5, where there was an incident at the very end of Belshazzar's life that moved the kingdom from the Babylonians to the Medo-Persian rulers. And then in chapter 7, which we looked at last time, he retrograded 14 years prior to the chapter 5 event to the first year of Belshazzar. And tonight we're going to be looking at something that he had revealed in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar. So in terms of the way he structured it, it's obvious that he is doing a couple of things very clearly. One of them is he's switching languages so that the Hebrew of chapter 1 and the Hebrew of 8 through 12 is specifically for Hebrew-speaking people, which would be the people that were hauled off into Babylonian captivity by Nebuchadnezzar. In chapters 2 through 7, he was writing in the language of the Babylonians, and clearly he wrote in the language of the Babylonians for the Babylonians. So he had a message for both groups of people, the Gentiles and the Jews, and that's very clear. There's obviously two different audiences involved in the book. And then the second thing that's very obvious is he's not writing in chronological order, so he's obviously organizing his material. And the ordering or the structuring of his material is thematic. And that's where we got that chiastic structure, 2, 7, 3, 6, 4, 5, so that we could understand what he really wanted to get across. And in the chiastic structure, chapters 4 and 5 are what he really wanted to get across. And neither one of those chapters have hardly anything at all to do with prophecy. In other words, the book of Daniel is a book full of prophecy, but the point is not prophecy. However, for this study, the foundation of our study was laid by a desire to have me explain my view of biblical eschatology. And so I've approached this study trying to lay a foundation for understanding what the future holds in terms of biblical revelation. The next thing I was going to say as we start into chapter 8 is that we're going to go to the last verse and look at it. It says, I, Daniel, was exhausted and sick for days. And then I got up again and carried on the king's business, but I was astounded at the vision, and there was none to explain it. So, my point in reading that verse is that by the end of the events of chapter 8, there has been given information in chapter 8 that Daniel did not grasp. Even though he was given a general interpretation, he did not understand what he was being told, and there's a good reason for it, and we'll talk about it as we get into the information for the evening. The point that I want to make, though, is that in switching back to Hebrew and going to the third year of the reign of Belshazzar the king, Daniel is now addressing his own Jewish brethren. And he's going to be developing the prophetic vision issues for the Jews, because they're critical information for the Jews. In fact, in this chapter, we're going to be introduced to a little horn in the Grecian period that is going to wreak havoc on the Jews. Just absolutely terrible things he's going to do. And so this information is, chapter 8 is a lot like the book of Revelation for us. And what I mean by that is the book of Revelation is filled with all kinds of prophetic things, most of which, if the rapture happens pre-trib, we're not even going to be here to experience. But we need to know them. The book of Revelation, the only book in the Bible that says that there's a blessing of a person who takes heed to what it says. Point is, in chapter 8, when he reverts back to Hebrew and he starts talking about the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, and he sees this thing, and at the end of it, he doesn't understand it. What we're going to do, because my goal was to establish a legitimate eschatology, a biblical eschatology. Well, everybody thinks their eschatology is biblical. Doesn't matter who they are. So I'm not any different than everybody else, except for this. I'm going to stick as close to the text as we can stick, using the information in the text to interpret the text so that there's less wiggle room for differences of opinion. Most of the time, where there are vast areas of difference of opinions, because somebody hadn't even read the text. I mean, that just... Well, it's like the lady who was challenged to read something I posted on my website, and the guy that challenged her, she came back to him and said, "Well, I'm not going to read the rest of that. I don't agree with him." And my friend said, I told her, I said, "I'm not surprised, because you haven't studied it. You just believe in what you want to believe, not what's true." And that's the case. A lot of the debate that goes on is because people haven't paid attention to the details. So, we're going to pay attention to the details, and hopefully we'll be able to establish some kind of foundation for a proper understanding. So, in the vision, he says, "A vision appeared to me," and then he identifies himself as Daniel, going back to his original Hebrew identity. And he says, "It was after the one which appeared to me previously." That's the one in chapter 7 in the first year. He says he looked in the vision, and it came about while I was looking that he was in the citadel of Susa, which is in the province of Elam, and I looked in the vision, and I was beside the Ulai Canal. And I lifted my gaze and looked, and behold, a ram which had two horns was standing in front of the canal. Now, we'll stop right there and explain the setting. This is 11 years before the fall of Babylon. This is 11 years before Daniel went in and read the handwriting on the wall to the king, and the king was put to death that night, and Darius took over, and then Cyrus came a bit later. 11 years before that, Daniel sees the vision, and in the vision, he is in the citadel of Susa in the province of Elam. Those are Persian. That's Persian territory. The citadel of Susa was actually the capital of the Persian Empire. In the province of Elam, Persian, Medo-Persian. So you can imagine, Daniel's been in the Babylonian captivity now for almost 60 years. He's been a high-placed person in the governing of that empire for most of his adult life. And he has a vision, and in the vision, he's in Persia, which to him is a non-entity at this point. So that's part of the reason he was as puzzled as he was. But anyway, he sees this ram, and it has two horns, and the two horns are long, but the one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up last. So here's a ram that has the typical two horns of a ram, except that they're not growing evenly. The first horn comes up, and it's long, but then there's another one that comes up afterwards, and it's even longer. So, he says in verse 4, "I saw the ram budding westward and northward and southward, and no other beast could stand before him, and nor was there anyone to rescue from his power. But he did as he pleased and magnified himself." Now, he's talking about a ram in the province of Elam in Persia. So, there is already an implication that he is seeing a vision that has something to do with the Medo-Persian Empire. And just for your entertainment, I printed some more pictures. And one of those pictures is the first picture after the notes. It's the picture of the big image with the rock cut out of the mountain coming across the plain to pound on it. And then superimposed upon it is the eagle and the bear and the leopard, the four-headed leopard with the wings of a bird, and then this indescribable, horrendous beast that has iron teeth and toenails of brass and has 10 horns on its head or back, and then he watches and a little horn comes up and it replaces 3. That was chapter 7 that we looked at last time. Well, now, to the left of that imagery is my rendition of a ram and a he-goat, because he sees the he-goat too. But this ram is at the canal, Ulai Canal, And this is in Elam in Persia. So the implication already is that the ram represents what the bear represented, which the chest of silver represented. Okay? Now we know the head of gold was Nebuchadnezzar. We know that the kingdom that was to come after him was not going to be of the same quality, but it's going to be more powerful. That was the silver chest area. And in the vision of chapter 7, which is the beastly presentation of the human presentation of chapter 2. In chapter 2, it's a man. In chapter 7, it's beasts. Well, the Medo-Persian kingdom is the bear. Raised up on one side, he's got three ribs in his mouth. And that corresponds with this ram. Now, you already know that one horn comes up and then the next horn comes up longer. Well, that's Medo-Persia. That's Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian and the Medo-Persian kingdom. Medo-Persian empire lasts over 200 years. So when we look at this bear raised up, three ribs in its mouth, we look at this two-horned ram, we're looking at 200 years of history going by. And notice how quickly it goes by, because in verse 4, the ram is butting westward, northward, and southward. There you have three territorial aggressions. The Medo-Persian aggressions were in the directions of west, north, and south. Well, remember the three ribs in the mouth of the bear? Those are the things that he's eating, and he had been told to arise and devour much flesh. So now we know that the ribs and the pushing of the ram are the same thing. They're the three areas of where he's pushing, budding westward, northward, and southward. And that took over most of the Babylonian empire. So he says no beast could stand in form. There wasn't anybody could rescue from his power. So he did what he pleased, magnify himself. But while he was observing, that's verses 3 and 4, the ram. While he's observing, a male goat was coming from the west. Now, we're in the section of the world where Iran, Iraq, Syria, that whole area there, the Fertile Crescent, from the west would be Mediterranean and north of the Mediterranean from that area, because that's the west moving east. So he comes from the west, and he's coming over the surface of Horus without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. He was a unicorn horn. Goat. But anyway, you remember the leopard? Because this is the next kingdom that's coming. Because he's going to tear up. He says he came up to the ram that had the two horns, and he rushed at him with his mighty wrath, and I saw him beside the ram, and he was enraged at him and struck the ram, shattered his two horns. The ram had no strength, so he hurled him to the ground, trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. So this is the third kingdom, which was originally the midsection and upper, this part of your body, which was brass. And it was, in the human, brass, stomach area. But in the beast thing, it was a four-headed leopard with wings. Well, now you can see how it could move across the ground without ever touching the earth. He's flying. Well, a he-goat can't fly, but this is the next presentation. So you see what he's doing? He gave us in chapter 2 a very general outline of the whole of human history with a focus on this down here. And then in chapter 7, he comes back and he gives us the same overview, but he gives it in terms of animals. And again, his focus is on this beast down here because his attention's caught by this little stout horn with a big mouth who's making his enormously blasphemous boasts. So that's where his attention is. Well, now, he's already skipped in the human thing. He skipped this one. He just said there'll be another kingdom after you. And then there'll be a third one. So you didn't know anything about the chest of silver until you got to the bear. And then he skips over the bear real quickly because the bear is just told to devour much flesh. And his focus is down here on the indescribable beast. So now he's going back to the bear in a form of a ram. But again, he doesn't give you much information except that there's two horns and one comes up later and it pushes in three directions and then magnifies itself and it's doing fine until this he-goat comes rushing across the whole earth, and he's not even touching the ground. He's moving so quickly. And then that corresponded to the leopard, four-headed wings, which he pretty much skipped in chapter 7 because his focus was down here. So now he's going to fill in here. So his focus for chapter 8 is on the he-goat. You get through with the ram by the time you get to verse 7. The first two verses are introductory. So you only got five verses about the ram. But the whole rest of the chapter, verses 8 through 27 or 26, all about the ram. So what he's done is, chapter 2 is overview. Chapter 7 is an overview with a focus at the end. Because at the end, everybody's getting thrown into the burning fire in front of the throne of the Ancient of Days. And then in chapter 8, he comes back and he talks a little bit about the Medo-Persian ram. But then he focuses on the he-goat, which was the next empire to come. And he's even going to tell us the name of it. So, that's what he's doing. He's filling in details. He's working his way in a circle, in a sense, filling in detail. So, it says in verse 8, the male goat magnified himself exceedingly, but as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken. And in its place, there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Now, you remember those four winds? They were stirring up the sea that brought up the four beasts. So you have this four winds of heaven thing again, and it's really kind of interesting because the conspicuous horns are pointed in the four different directions of the four winds of heaven. Out of one of them, and he doesn't specify at this point which one, but out of one of them came forth a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful, or the glorious land. And it grew up to the host of heaven. And it caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. So here you have a little horn who is seriously abusing the Jews, the beautiful land. And it says it even magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host, and it removed the regular sacrifice from him. So we know the commander of the host is the one to whom the Jews offer their regular sacrifices. Now the regular sacrifice is the morning and the evening, or the evening and the morning sacrifices. The regular sacrifices were the ones that they did daily. And in the book of Leviticus, the sacrifices were laid out so that you had all these other kinds of sacrifices, but there were certain sacrifices that were carried out at the beginning of every day, which was in the evening, because they started their days in the evening. And then the next morning, they'd offer these sacrifices. And then you'd have the day part of that day. So the evening and morning, a day, and you had these two sacrifices. They're called the regular sacrifices. Well, this little horn, in one of the outworking of one of the four horns that came from the breaking off of the single horn, you have this one little horn that causes the sacrifice to the God of heaven to stop. And it says, he also threw down the place of his sanctuary, and on account of transgression of the host, they will be given over to the horn along with the regular sacrifices, and it will fling truth to the ground and perform its will and prosper. And then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the particular one who was speaking, how long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply, while the transgression causes horror, so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled? And he said, for 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored. Now, the issue of the 2,300 is a little bit complicated because it could be taken one of two ways. The request was, how long will the regular sacrifice apply? The vision of the regular sacrifice apply. And he says, well, for 2,300 evenings and mornings. So the obvious natural implication is he's talking about 2,300 sacrificial events that should take place but aren't. And that would equal half of that many days. In other words, 1,150 days. Because you have two sacrifices each day. So if it's 2,300 of the regular sacrifices that are, the vision says, aren't going to take place, he's been asked how long, and he's been told. Well, 1150 days is, in the Jewish calendar of 360-day years, you divide 360 into the 1150, and you end up with 2,300 sacrifices. And he doesn't go into the details on this, so I'm going to just give you some historical facts. There is a section in the Catholic's Bible that has the Maccabees, the books of the Maccabees, because they have a larger canon than we do. The books of the Maccabees were historical narrative. They weren't. The church never accepted them, even the Jews never accepted them as inerrant scripture, but they didn't have any problem with them being relatively accurate history. So in the books of the Maccabees, they have this history of Antiochus Epiphanes, 1 Maccabees chapter 1 through however far it goes, through chapter 6. So the first six chapters of the first book of Maccabees gives you the historical background for this issue of the 2,300 sacrifices that are going to be stopped. Interestingly, the dates are given. In the 145th year of this particular kingdom's reign, on the 15th day, there was a desolating sacrilege. The sacrifice of the sow was on the 25th day, 10 days later. But in the 148th year, on the 25th day, which was exactly 3 years from the corrupting sacrifice, Judas Maccabeus cleansed the temple. They tore down the old altar where the sow had been slaughtered, and he rebuilt the new altar. And they offered their sacrifices, cleansed the temple, and reinstituted the worship of Yahweh in Israel under the Maccabean military authority. That's celebrated by the Jews. It's called the Feast of Dedication. And it happened exactly 3 years after the slaughter of the sow on the altar. So that 360-day years, three of them is 1,080 days, and the prophecy was of 1,150, which means that there's about 70 days that are not involved or they're not explained here. So basically there's 60 or 70 days that are unaccounted for in terms of the historical record. I don't know what happened in those 60 to 70 days, but that seems to be the historical significance. It says in verse 15 that when Daniel had seen the vision, he sought to understand it, which is typical because Daniel had the gift of interpretation of visions and stuff, and so he was exceedingly interested, and besides, it was a vision that he was being given. So he looked for someone, and there was before him suddenly a man, or some that looked like one, and he heard a voice of a man between the, apparently the banks of the Ulai. The voice came up, and he called out and said, "Gabriel, give this man, Daniel, an understanding of the vision." So Gabriel's the guy he sees, and the voice he hears, he does never identify. It's a voice of a man, but he doesn't understand, or he doesn't tell us where it's coming from, except that it's between the banks of the Ulai canal. So Gabriel comes near to where Daniel's standing, and Daniel's scared to death, falls on his face, and Gabriel says, "Son of man, understand that the vision pertains to the time of the end." Now this is a problematical statement. The vision pertains to the time of the end, because the time of the end was revealed in chapter 7 as the time when the Ancient of Days was set up thrones, and the Ancient of Days judged the horrendous beast and cast him into the river of fire. This is problematical simply because we're not in the beast era, we're in the leopard era. It's part of why Daniel was confused. But anyway, he says, "While he was talking to me, I sank into a deep sleep with my face to the ground," which basically is just Daniel saying, "I passed out." And this is not unusual. If you remember in chapter 1 of the book of the Revelation, when Jesus was presented to John, when he heard the sound behind him and whatnot, and he turned around to see who it was, he saw a vision of the ascended Jesus in all of his magnified, majestic glory. And what John do? He passed out. It's something to be confronted with. And even then, this was not the epitome of the glory of God. God told Moses, nobody can see me and survive. But there were visions that approximated at least a significant part of the glory. And that's what John saw on the Isle of Patmos in Revelation 1. And it scared him spitless. He passed out. Now, this is the John that Jesus loved and that described himself as the one that Jesus loved. But all that love, reality, didn't give him any boldness in the face of the vision of the glory. So it's not surprising that Daniel couldn't stand the presence of Gabriel. So he passes out, but Gabriel touches him and makes him capable of standing up again. He says, I'm going to tell you what will occur at the final period of the indignation. Now here's another final period of indignation. It pertains to the appointed time of the end. And again, from chapter 7, Daniel would have automatically thought of the end being the end of the little horn of the fourth empire. So there's some confusion here. But here's the interpretation. Verse 20. The ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia. Okay, now we know that the bear and the ram are the same kingdom. They're just being presented in two different forms or images. He says the shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece. Now, I want you to think about that. Given the fact that Daniel is receiving this vision about 545 B.C., and the kingdom of Greece didn't even begin to exist until 333. It's almost, well, a little over 200 years is going to pass, and yet the name is given here. It's Greece. And the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now, not technically the first king, because Philip was the king of Macedon, but Alexander, his son, was the one who expanded the empire. He's the one who flew across the ground so quickly that he didn't even touch it. It was Alexander the Great that was the notable horn and the head of the he-goat. Alexander the Great had a couple of things that fit this prophecy like a glove. One of them was that he had a favorite tactic of war that involved his soldiers burnishing their armor and their shields, which were made out of bronze, interestingly. It's the kingdom of the bronze gut. They would burnish those shields and armor until they shone, and then they would set themselves against their enemy in the morning with the sun shining on their stuff and blinding their adversaries, and they would charge them. So, can't see, I can't see this. If you've ever been behind a car with a shiny bumper and the sun hit it just right and it's in your face and you all of a sudden you can't see. Well, that was a tactic that he used. Not only that, but he typically didn't have as large an army as the people that he was attacking. So his military methods, he was a superior military general, but one of his things was he would catch his enemies by surprise and attack them when they weren't waiting for him. In other words, if the scouts told the Medo-Persian generals Alexander the Great's 4 days away, he might show up the next day because he'd force march his men day and night and get there before they expected him, and then he would attack with his polished armor. And he defeated the Medes and the Persians, which had one of the most powerful armies of that known period of history, elephants and all. But anyway, the notable horn is the first king, and the broken horn and the four horns that rose in it represent four kingdoms that will arise from his nation, although not with his power. So basically what he's saying is when Alexander the Great dies, there will be four kings that rise in his place. And what happened historically was that his kingdom was divided among his four generals. And he urged them to make a peaceable division of the empire so that each one of them took something. One of them took the homeland. One of them took the Egyptian area. One of them took central Babylonian area. And one of them took the one farther east. Antiochus Epiphanes came off of, I think, Lysimachus. But anyway, I didn't review that, and I can't call it to mind. But that's what happened. Now, I want you to notice something here. In verse 22, we're actually told that the Grecian Empire will be dissolved in terms of a single powerful king, and it will turn into four kingdoms. So the image of the man where you have the bronze belly, it's presented as a monolithic unit. The leopard with the wings and stuff, there's a hint there because there are four heads. So there's a hint there that this is not a monolithic thing. It's a divided. And that becomes critical in the legs of iron and the feet, because you start off in this section with iron, and it goes into two parts down the two legs, and then it turns into 10 toes. And it's in the days of the toe kings, the toes of the man, that this beast, because those 10 horns are the toes. Which implies again that the historical, there's an enormous amount of history that's just totally ignored. You have an image that might make you think that there's going to be this kingdom, and it's going to exist like the Babylonian kingdom did as a unit. But then the Medes and the Persians are already the divided kingdom, and the Persians ended up being in the dominance later. And then you have the Greek Empire, which looks like a single unit in chapter 2, but in chapter 7 there's four heads, and in this chapter it actually turns into four kingdoms. And so the last kingdom, we shouldn't be surprised that the last kingdom started out being Rome, but Rome passed off the scene historically without great fanfare. There was no stone cut out of a mountain that rolled across the plain and pulverized it into dust. And the Ancient of Days didn't set up his throne and judge this in terms of the Roman Empire. And then it just kind of fell all. We ended up with all these different countries and nations and stuff. That's why they call it a revival of the Roman Empire, because in the days of the ten kings, there's going to be a coalescing back to one horn with ten, well, seven, working with him after he replaces three of them or gets rid of three of them. So it's going to be a coming back together of a kingdom or an empire that has been formerly fragmented so badly that it's actually 10 or more kingdoms in the final end. So what we have here in verse 22 is the first hint that we shouldn't be looking for a historical narrative that takes us through monolithic kingdoms with no historical interruptions or anything. Because the church age, which is the age basically of the disintegration of the first Roman Empire and the disintegration into all these various nations and stuff all over the world, as it is even now, this was completely held back in prophecy in the Old Testament. Nothing said about it. Nobody knew there was going to be a 2,000-year hiatus, because God never said anything about the church in the Old Testament, per se. It says in verse 23 that in the latter period of their rule, that is the rule of the four, when the transgressors have run their course, a king will arise, insolent and skilled in intrigue, and his power will be mighty, but not by his own power. Now that's interesting in the fact that Gabriel comes back, gives Daniel the prophecy of the 70 weeks, but he says, I have to go back and fight with the angel of Persia, which means that the power that's being exercised is not just human power. There's some angelic forces of good and forces of evil that are at war in the heavenlies, and what's playing out on the earth is actually a result of the conflict there. Anyway, it says, he will destroy to an extraordinary degree and prosper and perform his will, and he will destroy mighty men and the holy people. And through his shrewdness, he'll cause deceit to succeed by his influence, and he'll magnify himself in his heart, and he will destroy many while they're at ease, and he will even oppose the prince of princes, but he will be broken without human agency. And this is where the interpretation ends. The whole point here is that Daniel has been told about a little horn that will arise out of one of the four horns that arose out of the broken horn. And this little horn sounds just a lot like the little horn in chapter 7. The problem is, they're in two different kingdoms. This little horn is in the Greek kingdom, and the little horn in chapter 7 is in the latter, the final stages of the latter, the last kingdom before kingdom of Messiah. I really believe this is why Daniel is frustrated and doesn't understand. Because he's been told about a little horn, has this blasphemous mouth and opposes the king of the prince of princes, and you know, and he's cast into the fiery stream. And now he's given a vision, and there's going to be a horn before that horn. But they look a lot alike in terms of their behavior. Well, this horn that he's talking about in verses 23 through 25 is Antiochus Epiphanes. That's what he called himself. It means Antiochus, a manifestation of God. That's what an epiphany is. It's a manifestation. So Epiphanes, Antiochus Epiphanes meant, I'm God in the flesh. I'm a manifestation of God. That's how high his ego went. But his enemies called him Antiochus Epimenes. It meant crazy. Antiochus the crazy one. But anyway, the characteristics of this little horn are very much like the one in chapter 7. And we'll get into this more in chapter 9 and following. But it says that the vision of the evenings and the mornings, which has been told is true, but keep the vision secret. It pertains to many days in the future. And as we said, 200 years. And then another 100 or so. I think it was 175 BC or so when Antiochus Epiphanes came on the scene. And this is 545 or so in the third year of Belshazzar. So we're talking 325 years or more. But he had been told twice that this was what's going to happen in the end of time, at the end of the days. So this is the puzzle. And it says Daniel was exhausted. He was sick for days. And the reason was because of what he saw happening to God's people, his people, the Jews. And what he saw happening to Jerusalem and the sacrificial worship of the true God and all of that. And so he got up after he'd been sick for a while and he carried on the king's business, but he was astounded and there was none to explain it.